morning, everyone. Good afternoon to many, and good evening to our international viewers. Welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles. And if you are new to the show, please hit like, please hit subscribe, and don't forget to hit the notifications bell as we are constantly adding new programming to the channel and doing special event shows all the time. Just this past week, we did a cross stream with our friends 99 Zoo Eins in Germany about revolutionary movements and metal. It was interesting. And also, we did a cross stream with the launch of Sublation Magazine, a magazine that I have a new piece that's coming out, I believe, either Sunday or Monday. So go to sublationmagazine.com and you can check out the pieces that are already up, which are fabulous. There's definitely other members of the TIR crew that are writing for the magazine. Pretty much the magazine is just a vehicle for us to voice our opinions in print. Pascal is writing for the magazine as well. I'm actually very excited for his first piece to drop. Don't know exactly when. And he will definitely be back Tuesday as we talk to Randy Shaw about the hotels for the unhoused in San Francisco and how that area is attacking homelessness and how it's kind of attacking some of the mechanisms that is helping to stop homelessness. So that is going to be our Tuesday show. And also, this past Wednesday, we premiered the latest video essay, Welcome to the Terror Dome, kind of talking about the LA riots. So check that out. And also check out the subsequent recap show with me and Pascal talking about the 90s, the economic conditions that were part of the riots. We definitely take a deep dive into the causation of these things. That being said, I do today have a special co-host. She was a guest before, about a year ago. And Pascal and I were like, we got to bring this woman back. Pascal was like, dude, we got to make her a part of the show. She was like, sorry, guys, can't. I'm a super mom and I'm a super entrepreneurial spirit and I'm working all these jobs. But I'll throw guests your way. And she definitely did. She definitely did help us out with a very important show we did last year during the events that were happening in Tigray. She's also a wealth of information that I definitely have no problem trying to tap, especially when it comes to issues surrounding technology. I met her through also another show guest and contributor to Sublation Magazine, Dwayne Monroe. He would retweet a lot of her stuff as well. So please welcome. Let's read her resume first. She is the director of We Be Imagining at Columbia University and the UCLA C212 Tech Research Fellow. She's coming all the way live from BK all day. Please welcome Khadija Abdurrahman. You have no sound. See, you were talking all that shit, and now you have no sound. You muted yourself. You still muted yourself. Oh, no. I didn't do it. You might have to refresh. Hold on. She figured it out. By the way, she works in tech. I just want you to know that. So when you have technical issues, it is not because you're stupid. It's because machines suck.
How's that? Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Yay.
How are you feeling this wonderful Saturday? For me, Saturday morning. For you, Saturday afternoon.
Really excited to be a part of this conversation. Also feel like I'm leaping into the flame. So, you know,
look,
Got my game face on.
What flames do you think you're leaping into? This is a nice chat. The last show that we did, not with you, because the show we did with you was more centered around technology.
Well, they're more focused on predictive risk modeling in the child welfare system.
Oh, wow.
But I always joke around, you know, in Mein Kampf, how Hitler was so thankful to the Americans because that he was inspired by American eugenics. I always joke around that's because he could not read geese. The legacy of fascism in the Horn is so much more deeper and intricate. Originating around the time of Christ, that it's just, you know, a very intense, always an intense backdrop of the conversation.
And I want to brag about you for a little bit. Please let me brag about you for a little bit, because Dwayne Monroe was retweeting you and he was like, this woman is just fascinating. And so the first conversation we had was about, you know, yeah, the child welfare system and the predictive software. And I don't even remember how we got into an Ethiopia conversation. But when the Ethiopia conversation came up, you were giving me so much contextual information so I could be ready for the show that I was like, well, can just come on the show. You're like, no, I just don't think I know enough. I was like, you're giving me the history of the whole region. But she's, I'm not all the way prepared. So the fact that you are coming on today for me is a huge, I'm honored. I want you to know that I'm honored.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, your kids is yelling at you already?
Sorry, I got like a whole little soccer team of kids and somebody.
People make jokes about me, Khadijah, all the time for having 27 kids. Khadijah definitely rivals my kid total, and they're all in her house. I ran to another country to get away from mine. They're in her house. Just remember that. But before we bring in our esteemed guest, who I met on the wonderful David Feldman show, let's play a clip to give us a little bit of background. And this was a clip I made, an intro clip I made for that show about 6-7 months ago, if not a little longer. I think it was the summer, so probably almost a year ago, when the events in Tigray were really jumping off and becoming news here in the States. So this will give us a little bit of background context.
This will be the first meeting for President John F. Kennedy and Mrs. Kennedy with the man who played a leading role in the creation of African unity.
Gentlemen, I know I speak in behalf of all of my fellow Americans in welcoming His Imperial Majesty back to the United States. Since His Majesty visited the United States nearly a decade ago, we have seen one of the most extraordinary revolutions in history, and that has been the appearance on the world scene of 29 independent countries in the short space of less than 10 years, including over 150 million people. The conference recently held in His Majesty's capital served, I think, to bring together in a great cooperative movement the people of most of these countries. And the success of that conference was due in no small part to the leadership of our distinguished guest. His efforts to move his country forward and provide a better life for its people, and his efforts throughout the world, which stretch back over 30 or 40 years. For all of this, Your Majesty, we take the greatest pride in welcoming you here. You do us honor, and I can assure you that there is no guest that we will receive in this country that will give a greater sense of lively of pride and satisfaction to the American people that your presence here today.
Ethiopia has long been an exception amongst African states, an indigenous power that, apart from a brief period of Italian occupation, remained free from the privations of European colonial rule. Despite this, the transformation of the decentralized and multi-ethnic pre-modern Ethiopian kingdom into a consolidated modern nation-state has been a painful process. The most recent example of this has been in the Tigray region, home to members of the Tigrayna ethnic group. Since late 2020, an ever-escalating cycle of violence involving not only the Ethiopian central government, but various ethnic militias as well as neighboring states has triggered waves of refugees and led to accusations of genocide and ethnic cleansing. What are the historical origins of the conflict in Tigray? What explains this latest outbreak of violence? And what does it mean for the future of Ethiopia? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
Security was on high alert in the Ethiopian town of Ambo on Thursday as popular protest singer Hachalu Hundessa's funeral was held. His murder on Monday night sparked protests in Addis Ababa and the surrounding Oromia region, in which more than 80 people have died. The killing has tapped into grievances fueled by decades of government repression and what the Oromo, Ethiopia's biggest ethnic group, describe as their historic exclusion from political power. Addis resident Ishetu Alamu says he's heartbroken by Hachalu's death.
Hachalu is not an ordinary individual. He's pure Ethiopian and pure Oromo. I am angry. It's eating me up inside.
Hachalu provided a soundtrack to a generation of young protesters. Their 3 years of bloody street demonstrations resulted in the unprecedented resignation of the Prime Minister in 2018 and the appointment of reformist Abiy Ahmed.
All right. Let's bring in our guest. Please welcome our guest, Awed Weld Michael. He's a former refugee from a remote refugee camp in Sudan. His academic work touches on colonialism, decolonization, revolutions, nationalist movements, peace, conflict, and security studies relevant to Africa and Southeast Asia. Please welcome Awed Velda Michael. I hope I didn't say your name wrong.
Hello, Jason. Hello, Khadija. What a pleasure to meet you virtually, finally.
First of all, thank you for getting back to me and coming on the show. We had an interesting time on David Feldman's show. I think David didn't know. He was like, oh, damn, there's a lot of Ethiopian stuff I didn't know. And that's always how I feel whenever I talk to Khadija. So there's a lot of
stuff I don't know. But yeah, I'm excited to be here with you today, Awed, because when Jason first asked me and I was like, Ethiopia is such a loaded topic. And as we know on the left, it's often an extension of Abiy himself. So I was like, who's going to be the guest? And then when Jason shared it with you, I was like, okay, how come?
I feel honored, truly.
Well, first and foremost, let's give a little context. That even that clip can't give enough context because I don't think you can understand Ethiopia in 5 minutes. And what's going on right now doesn't go from 5 minutes ago, and it definitely doesn't start with the election of the president. But where do you think is a good place to start, Khadija, with some contextual information about Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa?
I have a few, of course, I can always talk, and I have a few thoughts about the overall context. But since you're the guest, I don't know if you want to begin and I'll follow you, whatever your preference is.
Well, you were giving a bit of a history lesson last time. I would say, would you start it? Let's first of all, there's going to be some acronyms that we use.
I mean, I could talk. I have thoughts. Maybe I'll share some of my first reactions to this.
Well, first and foremost, let's get the acronyms down, because we're going to say TPLF. We're probably going to say EPLF. What else are we going to say? That's an acronym. We should know.
A few of them that will come to us as we are in the conversation. Sorry to be a very intrusive guest, but let me jump in and comment on the film, on the 5-minute film that may probably launch us into a conversation about what Ethiopia is and isn't. True, Ethiopia is one of two African countries that have not been colonized by European colonial powers, the other being Liberia. How Ethiopia managed to stay independent was the decisive battle in 1896, in which Ethiopian forces, at that time was not called Ethiopia, Abyssinian forces, routed, totally defeated Italian colonial forces at the Battle of Adwa, which is in present-day Tigray. But what many people forget, or what this victory clouds, is that in the few years prior and few years after that decisive battle that secured Ethiopian independence, Ethiopia itself was in the process of formation, and it went on large-scale military offensive and expansion east, south, and west to form what is Ethiopia today. So while defending part of central Ethiopia and northern Ethiopia, while defending itself militarily from European colonial rule, it was militarily expanding to other parts of previously autonomous and or independent entities in the Horn of Africa. So Ethiopia is not this monolithic beacon of freedom around the world that it has been regarded, especially among people of African descent in the diaspora. It also has this complex history of expansion, ruthless occupation and integration into its polity. And fast forward more than 100 years to today, we are living with the legacy of that violent formation. Let me stop there.
Okay. Khadija?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a few comments based on the video. I thought that it was very important that the clip that you created began with images of Haile Selassie with JFK. Mm-hmm. And what I have found, and I'm just to be clear, like I come a lot from an indigenous perspective, not just in the sense that my family is from the southern region of Ethiopia in Oromia, like an indigenous nation, but in terms of like from an academic methodology, I think a lot through indigeneity. And so I've been really trying to understand, like, what is this reification of imperial Ethiopia?
You're leaning on your mic.
Oh, I can't lean on a mic. It's on my computer.
Yeah, you're covering it. Okay, now it's uncovered.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
So. Okay. I've been really trying to understand, like, what is this reification of imperial Ethiopia within African-American intellectual thought, right? One of the interesting books, I'll just recommend a few things for people, is Imperial Ethiopia by Nadia Norasain. And she talks about Haile Selassie during this media tour, which you were showing the clip of, having the quote-unquote it factor, which is really interesting because Ethiopia has this like exceptional blackness versus this ancient black Christian kingdom, but also exceptionally non-black in the sense that Haile Selassie claims that he is not black. And you see Abiy Ahmed, the current prime minister of Ethiopia, saying, you know, us Ethiopians are not like those African Americans. We have not been enslaved like those African Americans. There's something exceptionally non-black about Ethiopians. And to the point of Battle of Adwa, it's very interesting. There's a book by Mark Christian Thompson. His original book was called Black Fascism, but his latest book is Phenomenal Blackness. And in it, he talks about Malcolm X and his formative time in the prison, preparing for a debate.
there was a white dude who donated all of the French existentialism and German critical theory to the prison, which Malcolm X used in preparation for a debate actually about the Battle of Adwa. And he made the arguments that the black flesh that was splattered in that war by the Italians represents universal blackness. So at the very core of the ontology within African-American intellectual thought, you have the Ethiopian, the universal Ethiopian in opposition to the Italians becoming universal blackness. We also see this in Frank Wildhorn's Afro-Pessimism, as he has this like psychotic revelation in the beginning of his book that the Ethiopian
You know you are not supposed to bring up Frank Wildhorn in this house.
Oh, I didn't know that. But I'm just saying.
You know we don't like Frank Wildhorn in this house.
Yeah, so I'm not a Frank Wildhorn fan. But what I'm saying, it's important to notice, you know, Ethiopia, like how you said, is very complicated and so many people don't understand it. But then it's everywhere all at the same time. And so you have Malcolm conceptualizing what it means to be black in America through the Battle of Adwa. But you have to understand this is a settler colonial genocidal state. And where I might just differ from Awid is that I think arguably there was indirect colonialism in relationship to the U.S. and Europe. And also Liberia is similarly valorized within a lot of black history, but also as a site of settler colonialism where African-Americans thought they could do colonialism better than the white people.
Well, you know, Wildhorn would just tell you that's just anti-black violence and that they just learned that from white people.
But it's so funny because he wrote this living in Minnesota. That's like the part that really grabs me. It's like you wrote this and you lived in the place with the highest concentration of Somalis and Oromos. Like you had such immediate access. So it's just funny that like everywhere and nowhere.
Khadija is absolutely right. When it's the dilemma is that you don't know how much detail and nuance you want to give and how much breadth you want to cover. But she's absolutely right in the sense that Liberia and Ethiopia are considered non-colonized by European colonial powers. Not to and when you look at deeper historical analysis of those two phenomena, it's not that they were not affected or did not experience one or another form of non-African domination of some sort. It's just that during that formative period of late 19th century European colonial expansion across the continent, these two entities survived. And they survived, in the case of Liberia, by dint of being a settler colonial situation of African Americans, freed former enslaved people being brought under the Monroe presidency to Liberia, and they enjoyed some sort of proximity or sort of protection of the United States, and Ethiopia, like I said. By dint of that military victory and further expansion, military expansion to the rest of what now constitutes Ethiopia. So I am in complete agreement with what Khadija is saying.
And also, we also have to talk about Eritrea and Ethiopia and that relationship. I think that's very important before we even get to the current president and the current situation. So Eritrea at one point in time was part of Ethiopia.
Which time frame? Because
let's go back Ethiopia, to the recent, what was it, in 90, what year was that where they became independent? 94?
93. Okay, so Italians colonized Eritrea. Yeah. Starting from 1890, and they tried to use Eritrea as a springboard into further expansion into what became Ethiopia. And remember, I'm saying what became Ethiopia because the myth of 3,000 years of Ethiopia is just what it is, a myth. And so when that Italian project of colonizing this vast, resourceful territory south of Eritrea failed, they managed to retain their colonial rule over Eritrea. But when they were defeated during World War II, the fate of deciding Eritrea's future or the burden or the power of deciding Eritrea's fate fell on the victors of World War II, who had defeated Italy and Germany. And this is also the time when the Cold War was heating up between the Soviet Union and its camp and the United States and its partners or allies. And in this context, Haile Selassie emerges as a restored king, because Italians had very briefly occupied Ethiopia in the years prior to World War II, starting from 1935 to 1941. Emperor Haile Selassie had fled Ethiopia, but then with Ethiopian patriots fighting against Italian occupiers and the British pushing from Sudan, Italian domination or Italian occupation of Ethiopia ends, and Haile Selassie is put back on the throne. As soon as he came back to the throne, he wanted access to the sea for his country. And he sought that access either through what's today Somalia or Eritrea. He succeeded to get access to the Red Sea through Eritrea, because Eritrean internal political dynamics had not matured enough or consolidated enough to assure global powers at the time, especially the United States, that once independent, Eritrea would not become a pawn of the Soviet Union or a stepping ground for the Soviet Union, an entry point into the Horn of Africa, basically, for this communist rival. And the Soviet Union had clearly expressed interest to take over or to administer the former Italian colonies of Somalia, Eritrea, and Libya. In this context of a reliable, quote-unquote, Christian ally, that is Ethiopia, wanting access to the sea and offering all kind of alliance or support to the United States and its confrontation with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, and an unknown Eritrea, which is half Muslim, half Christian, and ideologically not yet known. And so the United States engineered a UN mandate or a UN arrangement whereby the former Italian colony of Eritrea would be federally united with Imperial Ethiopia. In other words, there is this massive country called Ethiopia run by an autocrat, and a former Italian colony, Eritrea, enjoying its own autonomy. This marriage of convenience is not even marriage of convenience. This arrangement was unworkable to begin with, because you have an imperial rule in vast Ethiopia, mm-hmm. and then small Eritrea to the north runs its own affairs internally, has its own judicial system, legislature, newspapers, and autonomous internal economy. So those were not going to last. And as a result, Emperor Haile Selassie's government immediately started to chew on the autonomy of this former Italian colony called Eritrea, until by 1962, there was nothing left of the autonomy to speak of. And Ethiopia forcefully annexes Eritrea as a 14th province. A year prior to that formal annexation, Eritreans, tired of Ethiopian violation of the autonomy and disappointed with international silence at the violation of this international or UN instrument, had declared war or revolution against Imperial Ethiopia. That war of independence lasted between 1961 to 1991, and it ended with clear military victory on the part of Eritrean revolutionaries against Ethiopian military government. But Eritreans were not alone in this fight. at least from the mid-70s onwards, which is 10 years after they had started, more than 10 years after they had started their armed struggle, Eritreans partnered with several Ethiopian revolutionary movements or insurgencies across the country.
What do you call them, Marxist insurgencies that were happening across the country?
Some of them were Marxist. The majority of them left-leaning. It's hard to tag that Marxist label.
I asked that question. The only reason why I asked that question, I'm sorry for interrupting you, is because a lot of people, especially now, there is a kind of new burgeoning left in the States that I'm sure Khadija would agree with, that loves the idea of symbols. And if you attach a hammer and a sickle onto your movement, people just assume that, you know, these are hardcore Marxist-Leninists and want communism. And that's not necessarily always the case, especially in this moment of the Cold War. And it kind of depends on where you want to get your weapons and money from. Do you want to add anything to that, Khadija?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, to the term Ethiopian, like I think you asked me earlier in the show, am I Ethiopian? And I heard in the clip, you know, Hachalu, you have the Magai saying Hachalu is a real Ethiopian. And, you know, Ethiopian is a loaded term. And part of what happens when Haile Selassie was proposed in 1974 is that people who were part of that monarchy, you know, a huge percentage fled to the United States and became part of academia and formed areas like Little Ethiopia and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. And they reproduce kind of the imperial historiography of this Horn of Africa region within, you know, knowledge production in the academic sense, within the even just kind of legislative city council sense. And, you know, think about what's the most visible form of Ethiopian, quote unquote, Ethiopian civil society in the U.S. is Ethiopian restaurants, right? If you have, say, an Oromo restaurant, a Tigray restaurant, that's not even really legible to most Americans. And so when we're talking about this historiography, you know, a lot of it relies on statecraft or romanticizes kind of this imperial era of Ethiopia. And then when we're thinking in this post 74 era during the Derg, like legitimately many of these, you know, kind of various political formations that I would describe were then educated in the Soviet Union as the U.S. you know, pushed for, even under Haile Selassie, to diversify their patronage. And so I think people legitimately took up quote-unquote Marxist-Leninism and even Maoism. But it was, it didn't exist in isolation. You know, it was integrated within two pre-existing political ideas about what does liberation look like, who should be included, how should that relate to national liberation struggles. And I just wanted to share one article, and I'll private message you the link because it's not open access, but I have a piece. It's called Fascist Colonialism, the Archaeology of Italian Outposts in Western Ethiopia by Alfredo Gonzalez Ribo. And I really love this piece because it completely throws on its head how Americans think about colonization. So basically what it's about is that the Italians, when they had these fascist outposts in Ethiopia, they were constantly drunk. Mussolini was so embarrassed of them that he wrote a letter saying, look, you're supposed to be machismo. You're out here like passed out drunk on the street. You're sleeping with the women. You're not setting the kind of fascist model that we need. And in this academic piece, it describes that the enslaved indigenous people and the Abyssinian colonizers shared the exact same assessment of the Italians, that they were useful, idiot drunks. And so classically, we think about the Italians because one of their foremost communication strategies to build up a political support base in the South was they pushed for the abolition of slavery. And so classically, we think of this as a divide and conquer strategy. But arguably, the Southerners saw this as a divide and conquer strategy because they figured, you know, the Italians, not only are they drunk, not only are they idiots, but they are from far away. They don't have their shit together. So even if they're fascists, you know, maybe we can ally with them and they will go away, versus the Abyssinian colonizers, they are our neighbors. And it can be very difficult. You know, they saw this, the Italians entering in, as a way of weakening Abyssinian colonization. And so there, I could talk for a long time, but my point is that
You know, within these narratives, there's also indigenous perspectives that kind of, you know, add another layer to consider.
Awet?
No, absolutely. So that Marxist point that you raised earlier, Jason, these are, I'm not talking about the Eritrean nationalist movement at this point, but the product of the Ethiopian student movement, which itself is one manifestation of the growing 1950s, 60s, mostly 60s and 70s generation of radical students who imbibed this revolutionary literature. And as such, something blocked my view.
Just close it. Sorry, that's Khadija.
Oh, okay.
You have a forgive private.
Me. Oh, yeah, okay.
Secret messages back and forth to each other. Like, hurry up.
Wonderful.
Take your time. No, take your time. We call this the free show. Take your time. You have time.
So, the revolutionaries of the 70s, Ethiopian revolutionaries or insurgents of the 70s, are nearly entirely the product of the Ethiopian student movement. In other words, they were radical leftists. Whether you call them Marxist, Leninist, or Maoist is a different issue. But then there is an added ethnic slash nationalist dimension to their rebellion as well, or to their revolutionary verve, so to speak. And so, yes, they read or tried to pursue dialectic materialism. Mm-hmm. Yes, they read Karl Marx and Lenin and Engels. And ultimately they pursued Maoist insurgency when in practice that is what it is. But there was the Tigrayan revolutionaries, for example, fought for Tigrayan rights, the Oromos for Oromo rights, the majority of Amhara for Amhara. There were very few who did not identify, who are from different backgrounds, who did not identify by ethnicity and pursued revolutionary agenda for the entirety of Ethiopia with all of its complexities, while celebrating or while recognizing the various question of nationalities. But once the push came to shove and they were out in the jungle fighting for their survival and for their cause, they had no chance of surviving in pursuit of a pan-Ethiopian agenda. And so they either fell to their ethnic slash national movements, or they were liquidated by those movements seeking ethnic or national goals. In any event, Eritreans by the mid-70s had also caught up, because in the early 60s, when the armed struggle in Eritrea started, was not revolutionary in the ideological sense. It was revolutionary in the practical sense. It was trying to overthrow an existing imperial oppressive system and empower the people. But by the late 60s and mid 70s, the Eritrean nationalist movement had been infused by young men and women with high school and university education, who read leftist literature and believed that their nationalist cause was ideologically leftist or was best served pursuing leftist ideology. Hence, there was ideological affinity between Eritrean nationalists seeking independence from Ethiopia and the various Ethiopian ethnic slash national insurgencies seeking all sorts of rights within or out of Ethiopia. And so when Eritreans managed to defeat the Ethiopian military government in 1991, half of that 30 year of war was waged in collaboration, either actively or passively, with Ethiopian insurgents who were challenging the Ethiopian government inside Ethiopia. One of those insurgent groups in Ethiopia that I'm referring to, and that was actively collaborating with the Eritrean nationalists, was the TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is now fighting in Tigray, which between 1991 and 2018 had dominated the Ethiopian government under the leadership of the EPRDF coalition. Again, here is the alphabet soup of so many abbreviations, right?
But before you get into the TPLF, okay, is this going to help us with a little bit of the context, Khadija?
Yeah, so two things. One is that the first article I sent you was in an indigenous Eritrean Kunama author, and then I sent you the archaeology one, and then I sent you a funambulist piece I co-wrote with my colleague Ayantu Kibetso, which we wrote almost a year ago, but I think it does give pretty good context on the current situation and some of what Awad is describing. Sorry. I just wanted to acknowledge we're almost at, 1 p.m. my time, and we spent so much on the history of Ethiopia and Eritrea. And this is very typical. And, I think we could even put up a lexicon or a map of various acronyms. But the basic point that you asked about Marxist-Leninism and Maoism is a lot of it was thinking about, Marxist-Leninism was a lot of it was thinking about industrialization and how can you produce a revolutionary class of people based on those workers overthrowing the bourgeoisie. And then with Maoism, but also in the Ethiopian context, we're talking about a country that economically is like semi-feudal, coming out of a monarchy into, at least under the name Marxism.
So Maoism makes sense.
And Maoism somewhat makes sense, but also it did not fully, give the language to conceptualize the national question. And so a lot of times we hear the word ethnicity, and actually very interesting, because Haile Selassie bankrolled the first Pan-African Congress, because of course he was a king, so he had bread, right? One of his explicit terms for his foreign policy was Pan-Africanism. And the way that he understood it is because it would obscure indigenous land claims. During this time, you have the Third World Liberation Front in the U.S. fighting to found ethnic studies. And it's kind of in this context that we find nation, in terms of indigenous conceptions of nationhood, transposed as ethnicity. And so a lot of times when you're hearing about Ethiopia and also in many parts of Africa, we hear this quote-unquote ethnic conflict, the tribalism, these kind of backward savages can't let go of the vestigial past, of feudalism. And, even if it's not like the State Department, you'll even hear from Marxists, why can't these people get it together? Let's just unite and be one Black people. And a lot of that, the lineage of that comes from during the Selassie era and then how that migrates within academia. But it's very important, if people don't understand anything else about this, that I want to say that in addition to the class and political economic analysis we can have, it's very important to understand that the legacy of this empire, which dispossessed indigenous people in the South, which, committed genocide, which is built on slavery. Slavery was a core part of the formation of Abyssinian colonialism in Ethiopia. The national question is really at the forefront. So we see the current centralized government trying to annihilate Tigray. But we also see forced conscription in the South, in Oromia. We see execution of traditional leaders in the Somali region, all throughout. So, I just want to put at the forefront, it's this national question in relationship to everything else that I would describe.
And you bring up a good point that time is of the essence. And you guys, I have two people on two ridiculously different time zones. It is the evening where Awad is, and then Khadija has to tend to the soccer team as the afternoon gets later. So do you want to fast forward to the current president, who actually comes out of Marxist-Leninism, allegedly? Awe, you wrote extensively on this gentleman. Do you disagree?
I was waiting for Khadija to take a first walk at it. Please, Khadija.
Oh.
Are we talking about Isaias? Or are we talking about
president?
No. But we're talking about Eritrea or Ethiopia.
Ethiopia. I'm sorry. Ethiopia.
I don't think. I mean, Abiy Ahmed comes out of INSA, so the intelligence agency of the like former regime. I don't think that, as far as I know, I don't hear him claiming about Marxist Leninism Maoism like really whatsoever. I think a big thing has been explicitly neoliberalism. We're gonna open up, you know, the markets and like privatize a lot of the nationalized, you know, utilities, although that, you know, is still impeded by the current war. But I would say that the very first book that he published was Medemer, which is kind of like Making Ethiopia Great Again. That's about unity. And unity can sound like, when we think about Queen Latifah, UNITY, it sounds very positive. But in this concept, in this context, it means forcible assimilation culturally. And then it also means in terms of like an infrastructure, like a government infrastructure, it's talking about centralizing the state. And so I shared a link to a Funambulist article, Tigray, Oromia, and the Ethiopian Empire, that I co-wrote with Ayantu. And of course, I don't have the links, but I really encourage you to share links to your work as well. But what we try to describe in there is a lot of these dynamics, the kind of the mythology of Ethiopia, but then also how under the previous regime, there was a coalition of various groups who decided on multinational federalism. And this was the first time that in the constitution it was recognized that Ethiopia was composed of multiple indigenous nations, nationalities, and peoples who should have a government, a constitutional right to regional autonomy. And this included being able to teach in their own language within those public schools. You know, the Oromo protesters who had ousted the previous government and who had led major protests, we call them the Kubi generation because they were the first generation educated within Afan Oromo, our language. But this is replicated all throughout the region. And so I guess that would be some context that I would give, because there's always constant news. But I would say most of the news, no matter the politics of the outlet, is basically body counts. So you see that some acronym killed some other acronym amount of people. It's very hard to understand what's going on. And they always say Ethiopia is complex, which makes me laugh because, like, is Europe simple? Like, I don't even understand what we're supposed to do with that statement. So it can be very hard to parse. So I'm trying to give that context because you have to bring an analysis to the coverage. Otherwise, literally, all you'll see is that like such and such amount of people died.
Someone asked, what's a good news source to follow this? Derek Varn once said, in context to Mexican news, he goes, if you can't speak Spanish, it's going to be real hard for you to get really good news. I would say the same thing about a lot of the news about what's being said right now. If you do not speak the language, it's going to be a little harder. Maybe Khadija and Awet could point you in the right direction. Where would you say for people to get some decent news coverage about what's going on? People are asking.
Well, one thing that I just wanted to add to that, I think that it's, you know, sure, it does matter if people speak Amharic or Afan Oromo or Tigrinya, like, okay, fine. But I think more important for people who are listening to this call, is a lot of this is contained within oral histories. You have to be in relationship to people who are from this region, whether they are diaspora or whether they're currently living back home. So, I mean, the issue is not whether or not you speak Amharic. The issue, and frankly, many people in Ethiopia don't speak Amharic, which is probably important context. But I think for too long, like, people are just supporting any kind of state, including Eritrea and Ethiopia, if they oppose the U.S. or if they are perceived to be in opposition to the U.S. And then no further questions are asked. And so I'm not saying don't take a leap of faith on me or on Awet, but build relationships, see this as central to the local organizing that you're doing in any other context. Part of having international solidarity is building up those relationships, because I can't just give you a 5-minute primer. It has to be ongoing, and then you will be able to develop the fluency in order to critically analyze and parse these articles that come out.
An absolutely valid point, Khadija. So you could follow the events on various media outlets, but you really cannot get a true sense of what is going on without those connections that Khadija is referring to. In terms of blow-by-blow events, there are many outlets in various languages. So just anyone can Google And so I'm not going to give out what media outlets I follow and bias you or expose my ignorance.
We have to admit some of those media outlets definitely have a slant to them. Even trying to compile clips for that short clip. That's why I kind of went back and found some historical archives that had the Selassie and JFK meeting. Actually, a lot of it had the whole.
But Jason, let me. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. No, so what are you gonna say? What are you gonna?
I wanted to comment on something very, very important that Khadija only touched on.
Please.
And I want to take a few minutes on that. And this is the solidarity that many in the West, especially in North America, are showing the Eritrean government and the Ethiopian government on grounds of being anti-imperial, anti-American, or anti-colonial, whatever you call those big terms, right? And mostly these are left-leaning or self-proclaimed left-leaning, pro-black, including the Black Agenda Report. And this is interesting because somebody tells me to not tell the Ethiopian government to stop its war crimes and crimes against humanity, at least during the early phases of the war, because Black Lives Matter. It's like, hello, the victims are Black. How can you possibly invoke Black Lives Matter to shield the Ethiopian government, the one of the perpetrators of violence against Black people, from censor? And then progressive and pro-Black anti-imperial activists and writers and journalists support the Eritrean government, or not support, parrot the Eritrean government simply because it's anti-American. And the truth of the matter is that there were days when the Eritrean government tried very hard to secure American alliance. It failed, right? But then the solidarity by these left-leaning American brothers and sisters is not based on the identity of the regimes in the Horn of Africa that they purport to support, but it's based on their alleged or purported hostility to their oppressor or alleged oppressor at home in the US. And so, in other words, this is not solidarity. This is piggybacking on these brutal regimes' hostility toward the US in order for you to strike against what you consider is an oppressor.
Well, let me ask you guys both this question then. Does it feel like anything that might come off as counter-hegemonic to the US is what they then deem as some sort of ally? Because as I said, my co-host caught a little bit of flack from doing the show, actually caught a fair amount of flack for doing the show. That is not why he's not here today, actually. But there was a significant amount of pushback that he got just for doing the show. And we thought we were pretty fair in the coverage that we did. We definitely did not discount any TPLF tragedies that happened. We acknowledged them, but it definitely felt like if you weren't towing a certain line, then... You know, almost as if what was going on was justified, and you can't call for a U.S. intervention.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, please, Khadija.
I'm sorry, I also have my kids are about to start their own revolution in the background, so apologies if you hear something in the back. But I was going to say there is, you know, within our diaspora groups, there is a tendency to claim what we see the organized Western left doing as like what all Black people or all non-white people think who are organizing. And I don't want to make that mistake at all. But definitely Black Alliance for Peace and Black Agenda Report have been some of the most ardent voices calling any kind of Tigrayan or Oromo
counter narratives to the state CIA agents, PSYOPs, like on the payroll of kind of various intelligence agencies, refusing to consider any kind of quote unquote third position, which is neither supporting U.S. imperialism or supporting kind of the statecraft of places like Ethiopia and Eritrea. But I don't want to universalize that and say that's what everybody thinks. But again, I think that the dissemination of that information is both made possible by the patronage of, you know, Ethiopian and Eritrean embassies. Like very notably, Abiy Ahmed closed all the embassies and then focused on pushing out mis and disinformation on social media for pretty much during the majority of since November 4th, 2020, when the war was started in Tigray. And then the other aspect, again, is like people just don't understand. You have to be in relationship. Most of this is not in text. You know, even for me, and I grew up in a like close-knit Oromo community, I have some more context. It's not easy to find articles, essays, to find the framework to begin thinking through the Horn of Africa. You really have to be in relationship to people. And so I think there's a lot of ways that people can organize and signal international solidarity without actually being in relationship with the people who are locally doing that organizing, who have inherited intergenerationally the histories and the counter histories of that region. And so we just live in a deeply settler colonial society. Yeah.
So to break down this highly theoretical, highly dense concepts that Khadija has been laying out, in the interest of people who may not have been following what we're talking about. So Black Lives Matter, not just when they are victims of white violence. Black Lives Matter at all times, and all Black Lives Matter. And solidarity with the people or with the regimes, far off regimes that are oppressing their own people. These are the critical questions that the Black Lives Matter advocates in the Western context who sympathize with the regimes should take into account, as well as the progressive or in their home turf are progressive, but in far off lands, they kind of warm up to or work in cahoots with the most repressive and brutal regimes that are oppressing progressive communities and progressive ideas in their own countries. And so this is something very important that I hope progressives and people of color in your audience take from this exchange. The entry point, as Khadija correctly pointed out, and instead of relationship with the people, with the communities, the entry point for these maybe good intentioned, I don't want to question their intentions, I don't know them personally, but for these misguided brothers and sisters, is that their entry point instead of the people are the regimes, which they frame as anti-American, hence allies, when in fact their alliance should have been with the people.
I mean, that's why I did the piece I did on the 98 riots. You know, a lot of the audience, of course, is in the States, and I thought that was, you know, a prescient topic to discuss the idea of looking at stuff through strictly a racialized lens. You're definitely going to miss a ton of context. And it's interesting that you bring up Black Lives Matter in this context, as it is it is only Black lives that are being lost, you know. So what is your guys' take, just real quick? Because I know Black Lives Matter, when they first started during the Trayvon Martin days in 2014, did make a trip either 2014 or 2015 to Palestine and did some solidarity activities over there. I don't know if they're still doing that sort of work. Do you guys see it where you are?
I mean, I think I would, the way that I understood it is that he's invoking it more in a colloquial sense, not like Black Lives Matter
Patrice colors in a mansion sense. You know, so, like, I think that's just like an important distinction. But I think that the question of race is very complicated, you know, becomes complicated in the Horn. And not just in the sense that rhetorically, like a lot of people identify as Abba Shah, Northern Highlanders, or Haile Selassie himself would deny that they are Black. They would say, I am not Black, I am Ethiopian. We see this reproduced in Little Ethiopia within Washington, D.C. and L.A. But part of this mythos of an exceptional ancient Christian kingdom in Ethiopia is that the Northerners are Semites. The South are Kushites. If you are a Kushite, you are more pagan, these pagan nomadic hordes, you are without history. If the North is an ancient kingdom that's 3,000 years old, the South is without history, and they are Kushites. And like a very, you know, because slavery was so central to the production of the Ethiopian state, you will to this day, if you are a darker skinned person and you have, you know, more quote unquote African phenotype with a broader nose or kinkier hair, people will say on the street like Baria, and they will call you various names that mean like Black dog or slave, and things like that. And so for within the like kind of Abyssinian conception of African Americans and as Black, they would think of them more, it tends to be more associated with Kushite stereotypes. And the reason why I bring this up, and I'm sorry, I'm going to say his name one last time, even though you hate him, with Wilderson, I was so shocked by this idea of a Beta Israel or Ethiopian Jewish IDF soldier being the canonical universal Blackness. And so it's very interesting. There's an article written by an Israeli, I want to say 2014, 2015. There were protests in the Beta Israel, which is what the Ethiopian Jewish community is called, in Tel Aviv, because one of the IDF soldiers had murdered one of the Black teenagers. And the person writing the article asked them, why don't you say, this was during the time of Mike Brown, right? They were saying, why don't you associate yourself with Black Lives Matter? Instead, they were saying that we are the real Zionists, you know, and that you shouldn't be murdering our kids because we are the Zionists. The person in the article specifically said, you know, that's sad what happened to Michael Brown, but we're not like those African Americans. We were never slaves. And so this question of Black Lives Matter is very important. Tigray is 100% Black, just to be clear. But I'm saying part of what is being contested here is the very nature of what is Blackness. And are you fighting, you know, if you want to be a Black king or queen, you can't be on the same side as the indigenous and enslaved people, right? And so I think the questions that we're asking about Ethiopia are core questions about Black liberation for the diaspora.
Well, Khadija, you killed it.
Here it comes!
But I brought up Black Lives Matter because people do look at it as a solidaristic organization. So, I mean, that actually is why I brought it up in that context.
And Jason, I also brought up Black Lives Matter because there are two white Canadian academics mm-hmm. who invoked Black Lives Matter to you remember, Khadija is cracking up because she remembers the story. Who said, who were telling the Canadian government to not exert any pressure on the Ethiopian government and stop its war on Tigray because Black Lives Matter. And that tune kind of went on, although some of us responded to it, it continued. But then I also wanted, what Khadija said earlier reminded me of Black Agenda Report, which was constantly parroting what the Eritrean government has been saying over the past several years, more a decade at least, since I if my memory serves me right. And just last week, I think one of the Black Agenda Report journalists mm-hmm. was in Asmara, and she was writing ridiculous tweets. And she was explaining how there was no internet in Eritrea because there were sanctions between 2009 and 2018, UN and US-led sanctions on Eritrea, which is the most ridiculous claim anyone could make. Not even the regime apologists say that. There was no internet, or internet in Eritrea remained very basic deliberately as a way of controlling communication and information flow in and out of the country. And that has been the case before the sanctions and after the sanctions were lifted. And more than the sanctions, what had been harmful to Eritrea was the policies that the regime pursued domestically, regionally, and globally.
I just want to also add one last thing. Is like, I don't know if you guys have had the pleasure of laughing at Sean King's latest scam about the t-shirts. I think he was hustling t-shirts, and you know, it's just so ridiculous. And this is kind of the register of so many of the quote unquote U.S. foreign correspondents or like the leftist analysis on Ethiopia and Eritrea. Like, I think it's hard for us emotionally or intellectually to even debunk it, because if you have context, it's so completely ridiculous. Like, the person that Awad is describing is just so funny, because they have a GoFundMe. We'd be cracking up watching this. It's like so direct, members of the government donating, being like, thank you, unity to Ethiopia. I mean, it's like such a joke. And I mean, as fascistic as so many of the dynamics are in the Horn, if you do take the time to really understand what's going on, so much of it is so freaking funny. I mean, honestly, the things that happen are just so outrageous. And like, you could participate in this with us, but it's hard to just strictly provide intellectual analysis, because some of it is just so basic and just so untrue. And they can only get away with it because people have no relationship, you know, to the specifics of African politics and culture.
And perhaps to jump us forward, so the whole region of Tigray, and I'm speaking of the population, the civilian population being victim here, not the TPLF or the regional government. So we have to be very clear here. But the region of Tigray, a people with a population of anywhere between 6 and 7 million, has been under complete siege for the past 6-7 months. And when the war broke out in November 2000, and Tigray was cut off from the rest of the world in terms of communication and banking and all other basic services, the United Nations World Food Program, WFP, estimated that Tigray alone needed about 100 trucks full of food and medicine and other basic necessities in order to avoid a disaster, a famine. And the blockade did exactly that. And right now, so we are in May, right? Mm-hmm. And in the past 4.5 months, remember, the need was a minimum of 100 trucks. And in the past four and a half months, in the whole of 2022, the number of trucks that were allowed into Tigray to ferry humanitarian aid are less than 400. Just do the math. 100 a day was needed to avoid famine. And right now, in the past 4.5 months, 350 or 60 to be exact, are the trucks that have been allowed into Tigray. That gap is the famine that is being inflicted on the civilian population of this region of northern Ethiopia. And as of a few days ago, it's been reported that active fighting has resumed, the intensity of which I am not yet informed about, but the fact that fighting has resumed is being confirmed right and left.
Khadija, did you want to say something? You look like you want to say something.
I just wanted to add a couple of things. I mean, one is that, you know, when we wrote that, when Ayansu Tabeso and I co-wrote that piece on Funambulist, we were trying to give people, you know, a basic analysis. How do you situate this in relationship to U.S. imperialism? What was the relationship between Oromo liberation struggles and what's happening in Tigray? And in the time that's passed, it's just been, it's hard to know what to say and provide this historical analysis because it's such a scorched earth campaign. You know, I think Awa did a good job of describing the level of starvation. But when I made the like kind of dark joke in the beginning about Hitler and Mein Kampf not speaking Geese, because otherwise he would have referenced Ethiopia, you know, we have viral videos on social media of Tigrayan people being burnt alive while they have children next to soldiers filming them. Just like the most supreme cruelty. And, you know, there is a documentary about the underground prisons and where people are held in shipping containers in Eritrea called Escaping Eritrea on PBS. And so I think a lot of people in our community are familiar with that dynamic, but less so that it's not just Eritrea, that there are underground shipping containers in Ethiopia where people have been held because of political dissent. You know, most of us have a first degree relative in our family who has been tortured or forcibly disappeared. I mean, there's just such an intensity of violence. Like when you think that image and that video of the person being burnt alive, and they were also Amhara nationalist leaders that were demanding cannibalism and that they be eaten. And we can trace this back to like 11th century stained glass Christian portraits of like sections of the Bible describing cannibalism as a way to deal with your enemies. So this is both just like an immediate and urgent need in like the Tigray region. There's droughts and famine in the Oromo region and forced conscription. We're seeing execution of traditional leaders again in the Somali region. And so it's this like twin tension of it's hard to provide the broader analysis because just at the end of the day, I don't even care about the history. People are starving. And I don't even know what the hell to do because we know that the UN is not like, you know, just an altruistic figure out here helping people. But I wanted to say, I see in the chat a lot of people asking about AFRICOM and, you know, isn't it true that when you describe a government as repressive, this is just for U.S. regime change? And look, my point is not that the U.S. is altruistic. My point is that Africa is not a tabula rasa for you to project, like that just people just unilaterally project their own agendas without any kind of interplay. So one example was under Melissa Nawi when he was receiving military and financial aid from the U.S. in order to enact counterterror in Somalia. Of course, okay, so the Ethiopian government had some kind of interest convergence with the U.S. And so they took that money. They did various, you know, repressive operations in Somalia. They also had their own agenda and then appropriated some of those funds to suppress, you know, Oromo dissidents and other dissidents and continue building this network of prisons, which was also a lot the model for Guantanamo Bay, if we want to think about the intensity of torture. But yeah, I guess the last thing I just want to say is just I really feel, and I'm not Tigrayan, and so I want to be clear because we also, it's just, I cannot speak for them. They're not voiceless. They have been really organized. But I think a lot of people are getting burnt out because it's difficult to see, like, what is the way forward. I think the call for Black Lives Matter is also a level of resentment that diaspora organizers are feeling, that they're not getting enough solidarity. There's not a clear way forward. It feels very hopeless. Like I can provide this context. I can talk to people like Awit, but it's not clear what is the way forward. And I do think in order to answer that question, you have to trace it back because this is not the first time. But I think, you know, a lot of people are just feeling very despairing at this and alienated.
I really feel I should shut up and just listen to Khadija, to be honest with you. Because seriously, she is just hitting the nail in the head like no other. And I thank you. I really thank you for the clarity of thought, for the clarity of conviction, and clarity of communication too. And so yes, we were giving you all this historical background and all these ideological analysis and what have you. And if we dig deeper in the 90s and 2000s, we could also, I'm sure Khadija would agree with me, we would also give you a very critical analysis of the Ethiopian state, which the TPLF dominated, right? But and many people hide behind that in order to rationalize or to look the other way in the face of this famine by design, that the civilian population of Tigray is being subjected to as we are speaking. And that is simply unacceptable by any human or ideological or political standards whatsoever. An entire population is being starved by design as we're speaking. Not for shortage of food and basic medicines that are needed, but starving is the end game.
Question many people are going to have is, why the forced famine? What was the impetus?
I'd rather listen to Khadija, because I'm still going to listen to her.
Khadija, do you want to leave that one off? Why do you think you? I've actually asked you this question before, and you don't. I know you don't remember, because you gave me a bit of a rundown, as only you can do on a Twitter back and forth messages we had some months ago. But what's the cause? What led to this situation that we're seeing right now with this horrible forced famine?
I'm going to punt a little bit. I mean, I have two like separate kind of immediate responses. One is that famine is a technology. You know, this kind of centralist, the Prosperity Party, which is the political party of the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, their kind of Unitarian state formation has also identified Tigrayans as a central contradiction to the state, and they want to annihilate them. And famine is effective, you know, like, I mean, this is like kind of biblical shit, right? Like when you think about what's happening in the Old Testament and they want to kill all the firstborn sons. I mean, we're talking about this level of kind of scorched earth campaign. They want to, you know, just starve out even possibly the future generations. This is why early on there was articles about Tigrayans that were trying to escape into Sudan. They were having, when they were caught by the government, they were changing their ID from Tigrayan to the Amhara nationality. They just wanted to erase even the conception of their existence. And then to pun a little bit, I'll just share you kind of an Oromo conception of these events. So Oromos have a democratic governance system called Gadda. And in Gadda, you kind of advance, you know, say you begin as a child. So then you have these different rates. You go at like 12 years and then 24. Throughout this process, you're learning about, say, astrophysics, agriculture, governance systems. And around, say, the time that you are 24, you have a vote among your peers that are within this cohort about who you potentially want to be a leader. And this keeps going until you reach the age 40. And then they choose among them, okay, finally, who's going to be the leader? And then they start teaching the next generation, right? And then Oromos conceive of this as rounds of time. So when the Abagada are the leaders of this system, when it comes to 360 years, so this is nine generations, they state that you would now have to reimagine the entire Gadda system because it's no longer relevant, because the context in which it was developed has completely changed. And so in 1991, the Ayantu, which are the timekeepers for the Gadda system, they said this is a crisis or a catastrophe where things need to be reimagined. And in 1991, they specifically said it is going to take between 40 and 70 years, you know, for this next generation to reimagine what that Gadda system is going to be like and to train the next generation who will then take it out for the next nine generations. So this might sound kind of confusing, but the reason why I'm explaining this is because when we're talking about a famine, I can't mention a famine in Tigray without telling you that these people's grandparents were experienced the same famine, that these people's grandparents, a generation ago, were fleeing to the same refugee camp in Sudan. Everything is constant repetition. So if we want to intervene, not just the Oromos, but a lot of indigenous people will think on this longer nine generation kind of timescale. And so I think that's the only way we can break through the despair.
Awet?
So the nitty-gritty of it is that when the popular uprising forced the prime minister to resign in 2018 and brought Abiy Ahmed to power. Abiy had a choice, and the choices are almost clear. He had to respond to the people, and the TPLF having dominated Ethiopian politics, along with the three other partners in the coalition from which Abiy himself came. So Abiy did not want to take the blame. He pushed it onto the TPLF. Although the TPLF was only one of the four partners in the coalition government that run Ethiopia. And so in order to continue or to sustain the popular support that brought him to power, he had to publicly distance himself from the TPLF. But the language and the policies and practical steps on the ground between distancing yourself or blaming everything on the TPLF and making the entire Tigrayan people from whom the TPLF hailed responsible became intermingled. And so you see this rhetoric of thinly guy under the thin guise or disguise of being anti-TPLF or being about rectifying the history. It's targeting the entirety of the people of Tigray who had nothing to do with the politics in Addis Ababa. Okay, so there is one aspect to it, the Ethiopia aspect to it. And then between 1998 and 2000, Eritrea and Ethiopia went to war. And the war ended in a sort of, at a strategic level, in a sort of a stalemate. And the case went to the international court, and the Boundary Commission ruled some territories were Eritrean, other territories were Ethiopian. Eritrea accepted it. Ethiopia rejected the ruling. And this stand basically froze the conflict until 2018 when Prime Minister Abiy came to power. For that, the Eritrean president, the leader of the Eritrean Nationalist Movement, who was allies with the other Ethiopian rebel movements, including the TPLF, now holds that on TPLF's head, or he holds TPLF responsible for the frozen conflict that had a devastating impact on Eritrea, demographically, politically, economically, and totally destroyed the president's lifelong work, or legacy for that matter. And so come 2018, and Abiy, this dashing young prime minister who previously worked for the intelligence, comes to power, and he is publicly distancing himself from the TPLF that the Eritrean president had seen as arch enemies. Creates a fertile ground for thawing of the relations between the two countries. For President Isaias of Eritrea, the test was whether you are sufficiently free from the TPLF. And Abiy proved that. So he retained the popular support that dethroned the TPLF and gained the friendship of TPLF's arch enemy north of the border. So this is the overall nitty-gritty or wider context to this conflict. And now let's come back to Ethiopia. There is that conflict of visions that Khadija referred to. The TPLF dominated Ethiopian government that ran the country between 1991 and 2018 introduced federalism into the country for the first time in its history, where ethnic groups or nations or nationalities were identified for what they are and were granted internal autonomy. The details of it could be debated, but let's stay a little above the granular detail in the interest of time as well. And in the 1995 Ethiopian Constitution reconstituted Ethiopia as a federation. There is nothing in the Constitution that says ethnic federalism, but ethnicity became a cornerstone of the new political dispensation. When Abiy came to power, he saw that as a number one enemy of Ethiopia's continued existence and pursued a unitary ideology enunciated in his Pan-Ethiopian Prosperity Party. When he launched that Prosperity Party, he effectively dissolved the coalition that had run Ethiopia for the 27 prior years. The TPLF was the only organization that refused to join the Prosperity Party when the coalition was dissolved. That is one major fault line. The other was the postponement of elections that were supposed to happen in 2020. Prime Minister Abiy said, because of COVID, we cannot hold the elections. The TPLF, having gone to Tigray, and it constitutes the regional government in Tigray, in the autonomous region of Tigray, said, you have no grounds to delay the elections. The reason, in fact, is not COVID, it's because you want to steal the elections. And they said that they were going to go ahead with the elections in Tigray anyways, and passed his mandate, they will not recognize him as a legitimate prime minister. These being the big political contours of the patchy spot they were in, on the ground, all sides, including the Eritreans, were preparing militarily, both within Ethiopia, the Amhara forces, and these are regional forces, the Tigrayans themselves, and the federal government were all staging all sorts of military parades and arming themselves, training and all. So were the neighboring country, Eritrea, to the north. All this is just a matter of time until this explodes. Who exploded it becomes less important when you see the deeper context of revving up to the war on all sides. But the actual explosion happened when, on the night of the 3rd of November, 4th of November of 2020, Tigrayan forces attacked federal troops across Tigray. That was the start of the conflict, and Abiy responded with a full-on war with the full backing of Eritrean National Army and Amhara forces of various formation. So in other words, the entirety of Tigray is nearly completely encircled by enemies. Khadija beautifully said that famine is a technology of war. That is one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, or at least the rationalization, is that we will not allow them access to the outside world because that's how they will bring in weapons and communicate with the world and what have you. If they starve in the process, so be it. But this is just the one half. The other half is the technology aspect of it. Famine serves you very well when you control the faucet. You starve, and under the guise of starving information, weapons, and ammunition and food to the fighting force, the entirety of the civilian population of Tigray is being held as collateral and is being subjected to famine. Sorry, I talked too much, probably.
No. Khadija wanted to say some final words before we go. Khadija, I know you said you had something you wanted to close out with.
Yeah, two quick things. One is just on someone was like, the U.S. State Department, well, they have an analysis of Ethiopia, blah, blah, blah. I just want to be clear. It's not that they don't have an analysis, but like what we see in contemporary, like post-19th century history, they like to deal with one group. They have right now at this moment, they've decided being his prosperity party is in the immediate what they want to go with. They're funding, you know, domestic groups to Ethiopia under the mantle of democracy. Because they always look at the immediate. They may have some sense of all of this simmering national struggles. You know, Tigray is being obliterated. But they're like, okay, there's a media blackout. Maybe we can just control this. We have to move forward our geopolitical strategic interests. Not that they don't understand, but they have their own kind of optimizing from their perspective. And I think underestimates a lot of those different factions. But that's outside of my final comments that I wanted to make, which is this. So in the beginning, you were talking about the 92 rebellions after the brutal beating of Rodney King, right? And right after that, Sylvia Winter had published a piece, No Humans Involved, where she was making a call to her colleagues, you know, thinking about Black studies and Black academics, right, to marry their thought to the impoverished and jobless Black people that are in these urban centers. And, you know, it's kind of this post-Baldwin era that Black intellectuals become detached from people that are living in the community, experiencing the greatest intensity of state violence. And so in this context, Sylvia Winter is making this call. And she cites Eritrean anthropologist Asmaram Legesi. And, you know, and so it's an important context here to know. She says Eritrean anthropologist Asmaram Legesi. Asmaram Legesi has written kind of the foremost book on the Gada system for the Oromo people. Oromos also are transnational. And so this is a big deal, right? Because a lot of Black American or even Black Caribbean thinkers are not citing Africans. It's still very landlocked into the U.S. So here she is trying to set this model of being like, here, there's people who have other worldviews, other models, right? And so when we think about other genres of the human, what is our relationship to the African continent? At the same time, flash forward to 2020, I was watching ERISAT, which is the state TV in Eritrea, and Asmaram Legesi, prior to the war on Tigray, was giving an interview where he was talking about
Eri
Tigray.
ERITV.
ERITV, Khadija. Sorry.
ERISAT is an opposition outlet.
Oh, I appreciate it. Sorry. Thank you for the clarification. He was giving an interview where he was saying, essentially, in Tigray, they are not human, that there's no humans involved. And I thought this was very ironic. And then flash forward to the present, and you see the brutal annihilation of people in Tigray. And so this is why everything is complicated. You know, I think I'm sitting here in the U.S. and I see this need to make the connection to what's going on in the continent. But we have to remember, like what Mudimbe said, Africa is an invention in terms of like thinking about it as a category of thought. So there's a danger of Orientalism. And then when you set into relationship with people, there's all these competing narratives within us. You know, where somebody who's like a leading Oromo thinker is also has some kind of genocidal aspects to their ideology and all of these complicated wars, right? So I'm just saying all of these things are deeply intertwined. And unfortunately, the legacy of Ethiopian empire, enslavement, genocide is just everywhere. And it's not some issue far, far away. It's like here with us, wherever you're sitting.
Once again.
Here it comes!
Tell neither of our guests are fans of pro wrestling.
I want you to do that for me in real life. Like just when I'm at the bodega, I'm like a dollar short. I want you to play.
I also want people to think about for a second that Khadija is a mom and imagine getting chastised by Khadija for like not doing your homework. I feel so bad for your children because the philosophical beatdown that they get when they F up has to be on another level.
They be beating me down. They be talking about autonomy and self-determination. I'm like, I just said. It was like the ongoingness of slavery. I was like, that's not what Hartman meant. It was not about putting your shoes.
Khadija, you should be very happy with that because fire normally gives birth to ash, but here is fire giving birth to fire.
I have a favor to ask of both of you. I would like to have you guys on. I would like to have you guys on with my co-host, who actually did write for Black Agenda Report. Not too much foreign policy stuff. He definitely didn't write foreign policy stuff for Black Agenda Report. But he did write for Black Agenda Report. So I would like to have Pascal on with you guys. It would have to be a Saturday because Awet is like 12 hours ahead of me. is that okay? Can we do this again sometime?
With Khadija live? Yes, anytime.
Oh, see, look at that. Look at that.
Yeah, peace, brother. Yes, Awet. Yeah, I'm down sliding the DMs. You know, I'll try to make it happen.
I get so scared because I don't want the wrong person to be like, who the hell is this Jason character? Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. And
absolutely,
there was too much knowledge dropped, but I think we got about right to the point where I feel comfortable if we do another show, we can just start right in the middle because we have the context. If anyone asks any questions, we'd have to be like, hey, we got two other shows. We talked about all this stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This is a lot of work. I'm appreciative. Love your backgrounds. And thank you to the audience. Thank you for the people in the chat. Keeping it live.
And I got to thank David Feldman for hooking me up with Awet. This was a wonderful thing. I'm glad we were able to do it. Thank you, chat. Thank you, everyone.
Absolutely.
A question.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jason. And thank you, Khadija. You really made it fascinating. And Jason again and your guests in the chat. It's hard for me to follow Khadija.
I told you.
I missed most of it.
I told you. I said, don't look over it. Don't.
You did. Yes, you did.
Because it's an engaging chat. And I knew once I had you and Khadija on that people were going to be extremely engaged and questions were going to fire out from all sides about a lot of different things, because again, this is one of those things that doesn't get a lot of coverage. The only time we think of Ethiopia is in the context of famine. Let's remember, was it USA?
South Park is killing us. The South Park, I have to say, South Park has haunted my whole childhood. Like, I was literally tormented as a kid, the Starving Marvin thing.
You're young. I keep forgetting you're young. So you don't remember Africa?
BET Late Night used to play the Feed the Children commercials, but South Park, because South Park really is not just the Starving Marvin character, but that like pushed into the culture this like LOL like African starving Orientalism thing. You know, like it's like a posture too that made it very hard.
You know the whole story about what is this, Bob Geldof and the idiotic way he handed off all that money to the wrong people. He had no idea what he was doing. He was just like, oh, I see some starving people in Africa. This guy says he's going to give the money to the right people. And then at the last moment, apparently people were like, you know, you're giving money like warlords.
Jason, the BBC apologized for that report because it was not accurate. The money that Bob Geldof raised did not go to procure weapons. And that is an altogether different story that we can get into. The BBC apologized for, and Martin Plaut was the journalist who wrote it. And but Martin Plaut is not in the custom of pausing, reflecting, and apologizing or correcting his reporting.
Well, he's very indicative of the whole scene. So, I mean, there's like Martin Plaut was part of a category.
Well, let me ask you just real quick before we go. there was the apology, but then there was another article that came out 5-6 years ago also talking about a mishandling of funds from the NGO side.
Okay, so there is an article that recently came out, and I have downloaded it, but I haven't read it yet. But I know the story quite well, because this is the period of Eritrean Relief Association and its partner REST, R-E-S-T, Relief something Tigray, R-E-S-T. So the claim is that REST was misusing the money for weapons. And the same kind of allegations go against ERA. But at the time, ERA and REST, which were partners, by the way, REST emerged later chronologically, but they were partnering. And they developed one of the most transparent reporting mechanisms, accountability mechanisms to their donors, which was why, even at the height of American objection to the rebellions in Tigray and in Eritrea, USAID was funneling massive support through these organizations, which were organically part, RIST was part of the TPLF, ERA was part of the EPLF. ERA was Eritrean, RIST was Tigrayan. And they were organic components of the rebellions. But they sufficiently distanced themselves from the political and armed wings of those movements and proved to their donors the effective use of the donated resources. And so I know these stories in depth. Obviously, when millions and millions of dollars are involved and many hands are involved, or it's a long chain, I cannot say it was watertight, there was no abuse whatsoever. But these two organizations made miracles happen and saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, from starvation at the height of the war in Ethiopia before 1991. So no one, no BBC, no Martin Plout, no nobody is going to come to convince me that these organizations were doing something malicious.
Well, you learn something every day, and I was just schooled.
Here it comes!
I don't mean to scold you or to school you, Jason. It's just that there is this so much antipathy toward the TPLF that there is this wide brush that is being swept backwards into history and paint everything that TPLF touched as all doom and gloom. And that typically is also peddled by those who either look the other way or rationalize the starvation by design, the famine by design that's going on in Tigray right now. And it becomes just no longer an academic or an intellectual thing. It's fundamental, core human thing.
Well, and now you have me wanting to, if you have any articles, please send them my way. Kind of debunking that myth, because not only is there a few different articles, I didn't read the BBC article first. It was in the Washington Post, I believe I read it. And then I saw another more recent one that went to revisit kind of the folly of Geldof. Now, as someone that has been in the music industry the majority of my life, I will say, and I feel very confident in saying this, I wouldn't be shocked if a musician didn't know shit about foreign policy. Bono sure as hell doesn't know all that much about foreign policy. So that would not surprise me. So I would like to look further into what actually happened with USA for Africa. There was also a, if BBC apologized, it must not have been that long ago, because they also made a spoof about the whole thing too, as well. I'll have to, if I can find it, I'll send it to you via email. The spoof they made about the whole thing.
I'd appreciate that.
Ironically, I'm very hungry, so I am gonna have to leave you guys soon. But I just wanted to underline what Awad said. It's very important. You know, from a tech side, I think about this World Food Program. They talk about fraud all the time, and the focus and the technologies of social control around fraud and the supply chain are always focused on the end user. But in actuality, there's a massive amount of fraud, to be clear. But in actuality, it's not primarily happening on the end user or recipient side. It's happening within the middle in terms of these NGOs who the state is then dispersing the funds to, or like whatever UN body is dispersing the funds to. That's primarily where we see actual massive amounts of fraud. But more importantly, this whole thing about TPLF appropriating food relief funds, it's interesting because it taps into, even though Tigrayans on the whole are not Jewish, a lot of the ways that Tigrayans are discussed reminds me of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. And it is hard because TPLF is surely like worthy of criticism. I mean, we could have like a whole episode just on that. We could have 10 episodes on it, right? But there's always this discussion of like, similar to how Heidegger considered the Jews as disrupting German harmony and being the pollutant from within. That is very much how we are seeing Tigrayans being discussed within the like dominant Ethiopian discourse, as a social cancer, as people that have often assimilated into the city. Like, there's a reason that they did public rounding up and detention of Tigrayans within Addis Ababa. Many of these people, they didn't have any visible Tigrayan signifiers. They were in the banks. They were very assimilated. They were not political in the sense of like being literally members of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. But they're considered this, you constantly hear about pollutants from within. And because Abiy Ahmed is also has some connections to Pentecostal Christianity, this idea that they're possessed by demons and they're scarring this like ancient Christian kingdom. And so this idea of aid being appropriated for violence taps into domestic mythologies about people who are in need, whether they're experiencing a famine or a refugee crisis, being internal pollutants that are going to contaminate this kind of universal Ethiopian soul. So we have to be very careful how we talk about it. I understand from the American side, we're always thinking about the U.S. imperialism and how USAID is an extension of the U.S. State Department and et cetera. I'm not minimizing or saying that that's never true, but I'm saying literally people are starving, and then their neighbors are justifying their starvation and the lack of access to the aid as them being potential pollutants to the Ethiopian, you know, identity.
And Khadija, you're hungry, and my kids have been knocking on the door.
Uh-oh. You know,
that's their bedtime, way past their bedtime. But I wanted to say something also in conclusion. So the NGO Inc. that we have now really doesn't live up to the test and performance of RIST and era of the 70s and 80s. These are some of the earliest humanitarian relief organizations, like I said, made miracles happen and saved millions. Whereas the current humanitarian organizations are deluded in their self-serving, self-perpetuating, quote-unquote, humanitarianism that fades in comparison with the accomplishments of RIST and ERA. And nothing that new journalism or research does could really malign or tar the record of these humanitarian organizations.
Well, thank you guys again for spending Saturday with me. I appreciate it. I apologize to all of your kids for making them late for bedtime and then lunch. So thank you, everybody, for checking it out. And I will see you Tuesday. We are out.